This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast. My name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the 21-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. Today is the 19th of May, 2022. And yesterday we had a rocketing day on financial markets with the S&P down around 4% and the NASDAQ down around 5% in the latest of series of slides, which have been happening ever since the beginning of the year. And to help us look at what's going on and the macro backdrop to all of the moves this year, I'm pleased to welcome Daniel Kraus to Definitely Uncertain. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, Darren. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, thanks very much for joining. So Daniel is, firstly, he's a really super smart guy. We've known each other for years. He's the co-founder and partner at Blue Door Asset Management, which he might tell us a little bit about in a minute. He has an MBA from the Wharton School in Corporate Finance, and he's coming to us from summer in New York. So Daniel, just a word on Blue Door, just for everybody's listening to understand.
Yes, Blue Door was founded by myself and a partner. We came out of Omega Advisors together, which was Lee Cooperman's fund. We had been working there together for several years. I started as a family office for my partner's family. I run the macro side, he runs bottom-up stocks, and then after doing the family office for a few years, we started opening up to outside money, and we're now running, you know, two separate strategies, a long only and a long short fund. And that's what we're trying to do.
Fantastic. Okay. You're the macro guy, so let's talk about macro. April inflation, 8.3%. How did we get here? Nobody remembers inflation. I remember inflation from when I was a kid, but we haven't seen anything close to this for decades.
Yeah. No, it's been quite the ride to get here. The global economy is obviously a really complex system, but it's driven by some really simple factors. And so I try to simplify it down to think about the inputs that really matter most and focus on what's most knowable. So when I look at inflation, I really break it down into four drivers. There's the money supply driver, right, which is just simply increased money is likely to drive prices higher. There's demand, there's supply constraints, and there's wages. And so over the last 18 months, we've had a really unique period where all four of these are contributing to inflation together. And so on the money supply side, the Fed embarked on its largest injection of liquidity that we've ever seen.
Yep.
On the demand side, the stimulus drove consumption very far above its trend growth rate. And I think just when we think about that really simply—
And by the stimulus, you mean checks that were sent to people who were sitting at home in Corona to make sure that they didn't completely close their wallets.
That's exactly right. And the two stimulus packages that we really did, the initial one and then the second one after employment was already recovering, really added more fuel to the fire.
Yeah.
And it drove a lot of spending in a very short amount of time. We overcompensated for lost income.
Okay.
And what happens is when demand rises above trend, I think it's a really simple thing to think about. When it rises above trend very quickly, even in the best of times, there's no way for supply to react fast enough. And so by its nature, prices rise.
Right. Because supply requires building in factories, logistics, right. You know, there are very long lead times, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly right. Now, we've compounded that and we actually shrunk supply during that period. And so the third main driver being supply only added to the problem. So directionally, is supply the driver of inflation? Magnitude-wise, has it had a big impact? Certainly. Anybody trying to buy a car these days is very aware of what that impact is going to be like. Then we add in the wage component, right?
That's the fourth.
And as the fourth step factor, exactly. And what we've seen on wages is, right, we're coming out of a period, 15-year period, where wages remained remarkably low. And wage growth, I should say, remained remarkably low, even as labor markets tightened. And there's a few reasons for that. One of which is just globalization. There's just a large supply shock of labor around the world that kept wages low here in the U.S. And the second is that post-2008, a lot of people delayed their retirement. And so the participation rate amongst the age 55 plus cohort really rose significantly.
Right.
We now reversed that in a very quick period during COVID's only recession where asset markets went up significantly. And And so you had retirees had, or soon to be retirees now had a larger nest egg at the same time that they were probably somewhat afraid to go back to work. And so you create a lot of early retirement. So that's what's supplying the labor market. In addition to that, if you think about the demand side of labor, the only way, like we were saying before, capacity is constrained when demand rises too fast. The only way you can increase capacity in a short amount of time is through labor, right? It takes years to build a plant, but you can add new bodies the next day. And so we had this simultaneous rise in demands for labor because you were trying to add capacity and the constrained supply. And so now we take all four of those together.
Okay.
By the way, we haven't even talked about the Russia-Ukraine war, right? Now that's just the icing on top.
Exactly. Yeah, terribly sorry. And you also can't have any wheat. So, of course, the Federal Reserve and central banks more broadly, but particularly the Fed, have reacted to this. And they've taken a set of steps, both in terms of actually increasing interest rates and signaling they're going to increase interest rates and what's called QT or quantitative tightening, which we're not going to get into, but is really just a way of sucking some money out of the system. How are those actions impacting both the growth outlook for the U.S. economy and the global economy by extension and the inflation outlook?
So I think when we think about inflation, we get very caught up in the number. It's 8%, 7%, but it's rising or falling, whatever it may be. I think from an investment perspective, continuing with the theme of four drivers, I think there are four phases to inflation that we need to think about in terms of how to position it in asset markets and what it means for the economy. Right, the first phase of inflation is rising, and by design, interest rates are lagging that rise. They're actually staying quite low because the central bank is trying to stimulate the economy, and that's what's driving inflation.
Right.
In that phase, you have strong economic growth, strong earnings growth, and you have strong valuations because interest rates are staying so low and money supply is so strong. In the second phase, we start to see the beginnings of normalization. And so rates start to rise. And so the incremental rise in rate is larger than the incremental rise of inflation at that point. And so it starts to catch up, but it's still well behind. And that's what we started to see at the end of last year. The third phase, which was, you know, the very beginning of this year, is where valuations start to catch up with that rise in rates. So valuations start to catch down, I should say, to that rise in
rates. If only catch up.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what we've been seeing the first quarter of this year. Where we are headed now, I think, is clear, which is that fourth phase where the Fed puts the economy in the crosshairs. And the Fed says, we got to get inflation down. And the only way we're getting inflation down is by weakening demand. And what that means is that any subsequent rise in inflation from that point is actually the risk becomes one of negative growth rather than higher inflation. Because the reaction function becomes every time you increase inflation, you're now going to increase the tightening from the Fed even greater than that increase in inflation. And so from a cycle point of view, it actually points to lower inflation and lower growth later once the Fed gets into this mode. And I think that's the phase that we're in now. Now, what's tricky at the moment is if you go back to the four drivers of inflation, I think it's quite clear over the next year or two, money supply inflation, right? Monetary inflation will not be the driver.
So that's the sucking out of cash out of the system as effectively the Fed removes the quantitative easing that it had put in place immediately after COVID.
Yeah, exactly right. And so if money supply, when you have monetary inflation, as we mentioned earlier, that's good for asset prices, right? More money, asset prices go up.
Hey, that's the first place it goes.
Exactly. When you have inflation that's not monetary driven, that's actually quite poor for asset prices.
Yeah.
And I think that's the potential of where we're headed now, where either inflation starts to roll over, or if inflation doesn't roll over, it's because of the supply side and the wages side, not both of which are negative for margins. And so the importance of inflation rolling over now for asset prices and investments is significantly greater than when we were looking 9 months ago at inflation. And I think that's a really important point because we have to distinguish from an investment point of view, whether we have monetary inflation or some other form.
Okay. So over the four drivers, monetary inflation is coming down. Demand is also coming down because interest rates have gone up. People have less cash. There's also the reverse of the wealth effect because people have got, they see their stock portfolios reduce, shrink, something they haven't seen in a couple of years. So they feel poorer, they spend less money, go on fewer holidays, buy fewer luxury items, those types of things. But then you've still got the supply constraints and the wage constraints, which are, and that's the sort of unknown quantity.
That's exactly right. And I think that when we talk about it, your question on, you know, the Fed tightening and what that means, you know, I think it's really important to distinguish between the Fed funds rate and what's going on in the economy. Go try telling somebody who's trying to buy a house, don't worry, the Fed funds rate is only 1%.
His mortgage is 6%, not 3% like last year.
Exactly. And so the economy doesn't fund off of the Fed funds rate. And so I think when people look at the Fed funds rate and say, the Fed's still quite easy, we're just at 1%, it might miss the point a little bit, because corporates fund through the LIBOR rate system, which is significantly higher than the Fed funds rate currently.
Yeah.
And households fund through the mortgage system. When I look at those things, so when I look at the payment on a house based on the average cost of a house and the mortgage rate, and I look at that as a percent of the average income in the country, you know, when I look at that historically, it's more consistent with the Fed funds rate that's 3.5%+ than that's 1%.
So what you're saying is that really the economy or the players in the economy have to a certain extent done the Fed's job for it, which is they've pushed rates up in the real economy, you know, whether it's, you know, auto loans or home loans, or frankly, you know, corporate loans and the bond market. Even though the Fed's only made a couple of incremental steps. And so there's like this great communication mechanism when someone's spoken at one end of the tin can, it's gone down the little string and it's coming out nice and loud on the other side of the tin can.
I think that's exactly right. And as we talk about inflation, Darren, I think it's important to also separate between the cyclical driver and secular. And so the Fed matters a lot for the cycle, right? We're going through recession and stocks inflation. I recently heard someone talking who said, decarbonization in the world is deglobalization. The global supply chain is meant to transport oil and gas around the world. We can't buy the sun from Saudi Arabia. And so to the extent that we want to use less carbon, you actually need to build more infrastructure in all the localities around the world. And so to that extent, that's a different conversation, right? That's a conversation of the long-term drivers of nominal GDP growth and having to build out infrastructure here. In the cycle perspective, none of that really matters, because if you dry up credit, none of it can happen.
Right.
On a 10-year perspective, that stuff can matter a lot.
And let's just take that point. It's a really interesting point. Let's take that point to a little bit further. So as we move to a decarbonized world, we wouldn't call it a decarbonized world, but a lower carbon chomping world, excuse that terrible turn of phrase. Does that mean that we end up with increased inflation because production starts to happen in higher cost regions and there's less international trade? Or does that actually mean decreasing inflation because we have cheaper sources of energy and we don't have to transport it all over the place?
I think it depends on the time frame, right? I think as a rule, when you are, the best way to bring down inflation is productivity. When you are forcing projects because of regulatory requirements, it is almost definitely going to be a less productive use of capital than if the market is allocating that capital to the highest return projects. And so to the extent that you force lower productivity driven investment over the short term, that's inflationary, right? Now, in the long term, you're creating infrastructure to allow for cheaper energy and to allow for a more robust supply chain and all that. So in the long term, that actually probably benefits the economy significantly, both from a growth and inflation perspective. But the build-out period is more likely to be inflationary should the credit allowed to flow and all that.
Okay. So what you're describing now is a real problem for the Fed, and this is not the first time that central bankers have had to deal with this, which is walking the line between reducing prices without tipping us into a deep recession. How successful have central bankers, and particularly the Fed, been in the past in doing exactly that and getting that balance right?
So, look, I think what's clear right now is the markets are putting in their vote for how successful the Fed has been, right?
Not very.
Yes, exactly. The history tells you not very as well. The history of it is high inflation cycles tend to be significantly shorter than low inflation cycles. And the Fed is a large part of that. Right. The Fed gets very worried about inflation expectations. What do you, Darren and Daniel, think inflation is going to look like? And maybe you'll bring forward purchases because of that, which will only perpetuate more inflation.
And for those who didn't do Macro 101, The idea of inflation expectations is as people get used to high inflation, they start to price it into their thinking. They start to price it into their wages. They push for wage increases, and then it becomes a sort of self-perpetuating cycle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the thing that the Fed is most afraid of happening.
Yeah.
They call it unanchoring of inflation expectations. And so when they get focused on that, it essentially means that they're much more tolerant of weaker economy in order to impact people's inflation expectations. And so what you saw from Powell actually this past week was he's made a comment about soft landing several times. We can avoid the recession, we can bring inflation down and all that. And then this past week, he made a comment saying, if we do have the hard landing, we do the recession, maybe because of factors that are outside of the Fed's control, which was very telling, telling you, hey, it's not our fault. He's pre-excusing the inflation, the recession.
I've got it under control. I've got it under control. I haven't got it under control, but it's really not my fault.
Exactly. And so I think that the Fed has come to the realization that when your goal is to weaken demand, you don't get to decide how much demand weakens.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that they continue on this path, the odds of that weakening and recession becomes higher. And I think what's really important here is the pace at which they hike over the next 6 months is going to be extremely important, because you're unlikely, and it could happen, but you're less likely to get the economic feedback for the market from the economy to the Fed to tell them you've gone too far. That's likely to come 5, 6, 7, 8 months out. So if the hike too fast before that, you risk a deeper recession.
You're right.
And I was actually at an investment committee meeting yesterday. And I said, if you told me the recession was tomorrow, I would tell you, go buy everything right now. Because it means that the Fed's not going to get much above 2%. And so they're not going to cause a terribly deep recession. The problem is, if they keep on going, if inflation stays high, they keep going faster, then the recession that comes ends up being deeper than it needs to be.
Right.
And so I think from that perspective, the inflation prints over the next 3 to 5 months are going to be really important in determining that. Right. But to directly answer your question, their history isn't great at this.
Okay. Yeah, they get a 4 out of 10. So given all that, at what point do we start to see inflation return to a more normal level? And is that 3%? Is that 4%? Is that 2%? Where do we go back to, and how long does it take?
Yeah, I think what you said there is the important point, which is, what is normal? Is the 1990s inflation normal? Is the post-2008 inflation normal? And that very much remains to be seen. I wish I had a precise answer for you on that. I think that revisiting my framework, the money supply aspect will be weighing on inflation over the next 9 to 12 months. The demand aspect is not yet weighing inflation, is likely to begin weighing inflation in the second half of this year. The supply side, who knows?
Now, by the way, we had Hillel West on the podcast recently, who's a supply chain expert. And you know, he was making some very interesting comments about potential overbuild as a result of these supply constraints. And yeah, the potential, not immediately, but tipping us into a glut of supply in a year or a year and a half from now, as you know, CEOs say, hey, I've got to build another factory, I've got to go onshore, I've got to build nearshore.
I liken it to planning your CapEx and your plant expansion during a period of remarkable demand and high inflation is going to the supermarket when you're hungry. You're going to spend. There's no way around it. Right?
Yes. My wife often says that she'll say, oh, you must have been hungry, because why the hell did you?
Yeah. Exactly. And that's, I think, what we're beginning to see here now. In terms of when we expect, I expect that in the second half of this year, we will start heading towards normal.
Right.
And that being because the monetary side of it and demand side of it will start to weaken. And so even if the supply side is keeping things above normal, the direction of travel should now be towards normal. It's important to remember on the wage side that wages are a lagging indicator. And so that may take a little longer to normalize. Mm-hmm. I believe that by the second half, we'll be heading in the direction of towards whatever the ultimate normal ends up being, which I don't think is the current level. It's something lower than the current level, but there'll be a lot of factors to determine actually what that level is.
Okay. So given all of that, what would you view as the sort of major threats and the major opportunities for an investor out there saying, okay, you're smart, Daniel, you understand all this macro stuff, but I'm just a simple punter and I just want to know what to do with my money.
Yeah, so I think that thinking about inflation right now in isolation can actually be dangerous for investors for two reasons. One is that inflation itself is that risk will create recession risk on a forward basis. And so if all you try to do is invest for inflation, you may miss that problem. And I think the markets have been giving this message. If you, I told you every inflation print that was going to come for the last 6 months, most people would have not bought consumer staples and utilities and healthcare, right? That's the last thing you want to own in an inflationary period. However, it's been one of the best things you could own in the last 6 months. And the reason is because the market's onto it. And the market understands that higher inflation now means weaker growth later because of the Fed's change in stance. And so I think that's a really important point. I think also from a big picture perspective, right, there's always a difference in how you're thinking about your time frame and all of that. And so at Blue Door Asset Management, what we're doing is we're long-term bottom-up investors. And on the macro side, I'm trying to understand the cycles. Yeah. And I'm trying to look over the next 6 to 9 months and say, okay, how do we insulate the portfolio somewhat from the shorter, the 6 to 9 month impacts in order to be able to really live another day for the long-term gain?
Right.
So what we did was exactly that. We, back in December, we're buying healthcare, utility and staples and shorting the S&P against it. Mm-hmm. And we played that relative. From a longer-term perspective, there's just no substitute for strong free cash flow growth. And that historically, when inflation hits, you want real assets and you want strong free cash flow growth. One important misnomer that I really think is important to talk about is people look to TIPS as a great inflation hedge. Here's the story with TIPS. In phase one of inflation, TIPS are great.
Yeah. No one's yet cottoned on to the fact that there's going to be inflation.
That's number one. And also because remember, TIPS is still a bond.
Yeah.
And so rates stay low, which helps the price of TIPS, and inflation goes up. And TIPS really mirrors the real interest rate. The interest rate is less the inflation rate. Okay. And so from the bottom of 2020 till, you know, mid last year, TIPS returned 20% for you, right?
Right.
The typical bonds did not do that. So that was great. When you get to phase three and four of inflation, where the Fed has it in the crosshairs and interest rates are normalizing, TIPS are terrible hedges on inflation, and TIPS are down significantly in the last, you know, 3 to 5 months.
Not surprisingly. So,
exactly. So I think it's very important to really distinguish between quote unquote inflation hedges. What you're looking for in inflation, you really should think about in terms of scarcity. Okay. What in the last 10 years, price to book was a terrible way to invest, right?
Right.
Because there was no scarcity. There was a glut. And so assets didn't go, hard assets didn't go up much because there was a glut of hard assets. Right. If you end up with a scarcity of hard assets, then the value of those assets significantly rises, such that the book value rises.
Yeah.
And I think the way I'm looking to position a portfolio right now, from a shorter term point of view, remains defensive. You still want to think about the economic weakness that is on the come.
Mm-hmm.
And from an inflation point of view, it's about scarcity, which has to do with energy infrastructure, right? It has to do with manufacturing infrastructure. Those areas I think are important to look at. Logistics, those kind of things. I think that real estate is often talked about as a inflation hedge. I think you have to distinguish between real estate assets. There's real estate as a trade and real estate as a business. The real estate as a trade has made a lot of people rich over the last 30 years. You buy it, rates go down, you refinance it, or you sell it at a higher valuation quickly.
Right.
And you take your money out, now you own an asset with your money all out. I think that game's over, right? The inflation actually really hurts you trying to play that game. And so if you, your inflation hedge to be a real estate trade, bad trade. As a business, it could be phenomenal, right? Rent growth could continue to rise significantly. And so as a yielding business, it could be excellent. I think investors need to think about, don't expect those mark-to-markets that you were getting over the last 30 years, right? Where just the asset price rises so significantly over a short amount of time. But as long as you can abstract from that, there's a lot of value that could be had in strong cash flow in real estate.
And making sure you've got a significant margin of safety over your funding costs so that you're keeping you above water, even if you start to build in assumptions around increasing rates.
And that's the point about valuations adjusting,
right?
And that's really important.
Yeah. That's really helpful, Daniel. And I know we got into a little bit of the economic weeds, which always happens to me when I speak to Daniel. So it's not my fault, it's his. But these are somewhat unusual times, and it's really important for everybody to understand the backdrop of what's going on. So thank you very much for all that.
Thank you, Darren. This was great. Look forward to talking again soon.
I look forward to speaking to you all as always. And thank you for all those out there listening, and look out for more episodes coming your way.